We're on? Okay. Sorry I'm late. I was all the way down on Bloor Street. And I came all the way up to Chabad Flamingo, back home. All right, today we're going to learn about the Seder plate. This will be our final Talmud class for before Pesach. Next Thursday, with God's help, we will be searching for Chametz at this time. So we're not going to be learning. In fact, you're not allowed to learn Torah before you finish searching for the Chametz. So, this is going to be, things that we're actually familiar with are going to sound unfamiliar. Because you know what you put on the Seder plate. Everybody knows. I mean, like, we've been doing that ever since when, right? But here we're going to go back to the origin. We're going back approximately 18 centuries, or 17 centuries. We're going to find out that what we put on the Seder plate is not exactly what they once put on the Seder plate. We're going back to a very early time when this was still in a state of development. Was still evolving. Now, let me just give you this disclaimer. Judaism does not evolve. In other words, the Torah is a Torah. We didn't start doing new mitzvahs. The 613, all of them, all those mitzvahs were given to Moshe. At the end of the Pentateuch, at the end of the five books of Moses, we conclude the fifth book of the Torah and the 613th mitzvah. There are no new mitzvahs. So we don't have an evolution of mitzvahs. However, the Seder night and all of its profoundly inspiring and nuanced and detailed and choreographed ritual did somewhat evolve. The Torah didn't tell us exactly how to do things on the Seder night. The Torah told us, A, we had an obligation to communicate the story of the Exodus to our children. The Torah told us we had an obligation, a sacred duty, to consume matzah. The Torah told us we had a sacred duty to consume the Korban Pesach, the Paschal offering, and that it should be done with the accompaniment of matzah and murah. These are the things the Torah told us. So because the Torah told us to do those things, now we begin to analyze the situation. How do we do this best? And in the first Beit HaMikdash, people didn't need to be told how to do it best. They just knew how to do it best. Just like once upon a time, nobody went to parenting classes. Your parents just knew what to do. Or maybe they didn't, but they figured it out. Today, everything has to be taught. Today, all of a sudden, people are going to parenting classes and learning how to raise children and how and why and what. And maybe there's merit to it. I'm not dismissing it. Maybe we need this today. But once upon a time, people were just more intuitive. And without any shadow of a doubt, once upon a time, on a spiritual level, we the Jewish people were far more intuitive. We were far more plugged in. Yiddishkeit resonated, spirituality resonated, observance of Torah somehow came to us much more naturally. In case you are one of those who think that it was easy to be righteous in times of old, think again, because we have a principle called Tshuvas HaMishko. Tshuvas HaMishko means there's always equally balanced scales. So you can bet your bottom dollar, if it was a really profoundly elevated and spiritual time, it was also a profoundly dangerous time with all kinds of alien spirituality that you and I would never consider getting involved with in those days. Was very compelling, and it kind of sucked people in. It had a seductive quality about it that is long gone from our reality, like idolatry. This being steeped or having this lust and craving to worship a shaman, a spirit, or an object. I mean, to us, that's just ridiculous. We just want to chill out. Our Yetzirah doesn't tell us go bow down to an idol and go through all kinds of mumbo jumbo. We're not interested in doing that. We just want to do nothing. It's, I don't want to do all these mitzvahs. I'm lazy. Or maybe Yetzirah knows you're not going to listen to that. Just says, do the mitzvahs, but you don't have to do them so well. And everybody has a different kind of Yetzirah that targets them in different ways. Hatzad Hashava, the common denominator of all the Yetziraras in the world, they have one single goal, and they are single-minded and pretty effective. And that is diminish your ardor, cool your passion, somehow degrade your observance. With all the best reasons. All kinds of brilliant arguments and strategies as to why it's really what God wants. And if you want to be a really good Jew, you should do less. And there's only one little problem with those arguments. They're wrong. Otherwise, they're great arguments. This is the archetypal definition of sophistry. Brilliant arguments, full of baloney. Just wrong. How do I know what's wrong or what's right? I have a Shulchan Aruch. Look in the Code of Jewish Law. It tells you what's right and what's wrong. But I digress. Let's get back to the subject at hand. So we have this mitzvah that we should tell the story. And it's a very profound and compelling mitzvah. We know in the Torah God wants us to engage the children. We learned about this importance of the children even asking questions and us having to respond. I'm going to talk about this, by the way, it's Shabbat HaGadol Drasha in the afternoon, on Shabbos afternoon. Talk about the parameters of telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, how we do it differently in Erev Pesach, different than mentioning it all the other nights. But our sages, seeing that we no longer had the natural intuition to do things a certain way, we had to be told what to do. They created a Seder handbook for us. It's known as the Haggadah, and it has instructions. It's got things to say. It's got speaking parts, but also has instructions. And one of the instructions, of course, in the Haggadah that we have today is, here's your Seder plate. Here's how it should be arranged. Three matzahs, and then the different species, different kinds, six different objects that occupy their place of honor atop the Seder plate. And the entire Seder plate essentially is a tool through which we engage the children and teach, convey, and inspire their hearts, minds, and souls. Yes? So far you with me? Kind of makes sense? Beautiful. So one of the things we have on the Seder plate, right on the right, is the shank bone. Right, and that corresponds to the Korban Pesach, the Paschal offering, which we are no longer, sadly, capable of bringing because we have no Beis HaMikdash. And on the left, what do we have? We have a beitza, we have an egg. So we have a bag, an egg, and a shank bone. And what are the egg and the shank bone doing on the Seder table, on the Seder ka'ara, on the Seder plate? What is an egg and a shank bone doing there? What's the symbolism? What's the connection between eggs and shank bones? And why is that something relevant, meaningful, important? Why do our sages instruct us to do this? So that's what we're going to be analyzing now. So the Gemara comes along, we're on page 114b, and now that you understand what the Gemara is getting at, what the Gemara wants, I just told you the final product, but now perish that thought for a moment. Let's put it out of our minds. Let's not think about the final end product. How did we get there? How did we end up having eggs and shank bones on Seder plates? What does that have to do with Pesach? Matzah, that's a given. That's natural. We left Mitzrayim with matzah. The charoses, which represents the bricks and mortar, we get that. We understand what that means. The karpas, we talked about that. That's the vegetable you got to dip. We know what that is. The maror, we've had an extensive discussion about the bitter herbs. The Torah talks about that. The karpas is a rabbinic conjunction or rabbinic injunction or construct to get the children to ask questions. Okay, so it does something. We know what it's there for. We know what the charos is. It's learned in the Mishnah 2 weeks ago. There's an opinion that says that it's actually a mitzvah to eat charoses, to have charoses. So we use it as an important talking point. Slavery was bitter, bitter herbs. What did we do? We built. We were builders once upon a time. We weren't the builder as in the developer. We were actually in the construction site. That's what our people did. We built those pyramids or something like that. Those cities, as the Torah says. So the bricks and mortar are represented by the charoses. It has other symbolism also. But then there's a shank bone and an egg that have absolutely nothing to do with Pesach. And as I mentioned to you last week, there's no mitzvah to eat the egg. I don't know, one of our classes that we've done the last couple of weeks. Yes, it is a custom. I'm not dismissing that customs are important, and I'm not saying you shouldn't eat the egg. I do begin my Shulchan Aruch by eating the egg. I know the Rebbe did that. But it's not a mitzvah. It's not even a halacha in Shulchan Aruch. You don't have to give out eggs for everybody to eat. It's not part of the Passover liturgy. It's not part of the Passover ritual. There's this urban legend that the egg is about mourning for the temple, for the Beis HaMikdash. And people actually believe this. And I have no idea what the source is, because you'll see in the Gemara there's no mention of that whatsoever. And I'm going to introduce you to Rabbeinu Menachem Meiri, who the Rebbe quotes in the Haggadah actually and follows that approach, as to why we use specifically an egg. You'll see it has nothing to do with mourning and much to do with etymology. But first, what is going on here? What is going on here? So the Mishnah on Daf Kuf Yud Dalid Amud Aleph, the Mishnah said that what do we do? He viu lefan of matzah. They brought before him matzah. We're describing the Seder plate. V'chazeret, that's the maror. V'charoses, we talked about the maror. And then it says v'shnei tavshilin, two cooked items. So we've analyzed the beginning of the Mishnah. We analyzed the parperis, the meaning of parperis, that's karpas. We talked about the matzah. We talked about the maror. We talked about the charoses. The next thing that's left for us to talk about is shnei tavshilin, two cooked items. What are they? Why didn't you tell us what it was? He says, two cooked items. Cooked what? I don't know. It just says two cooked items. Why does it just say two cooked items? What kind of cooked items must they be? Why do we have cooked items on a Seder plate? What does that have to do with the Seder? It doesn't even say roasted items. It says cooked items. So the Gemara asks, this is exactly the question of the Gemara. The Gemara says, my shnei tafshilin. What are these two cooked items? I don't know what that means. What are they? Omar Rav Huna. So Rav Huna came along and said, you want to know what the two cooked items are? Okay, so here's how it goes. Silka va'aroizo. Beets and rice. Have you heard of beets and rice at a Seder? No, I didn't either. I mean, the Gemara talks about it. Nobody I know has beets and rice. But that's what Rav Huna said, beets and rice. Beets and rice. What do beets and rice have to do with anything? And if it's supposed to be beets and rice, why don't we have beets and rice? Well, the answer is that beets and rice were considered to be, let's just say, a cheap way to get away with this. It was like the simplest of cooked items. Beets were extremely plentiful once upon a time in the land of Israel. And rice was plentiful. And they were cooked items. So you could have beets and rice. Cheap, plentiful, available, and that way everybody can manage to have these two cooked items on the Seder plate. So that's why we use specifically these two cooked items. The Gemara says, Rava have a mahadir asilka v'aroizo. Rava was a real chassid. He was a real chassid of Rav Huna. So what does it mean to be a real chassid? He was so devoted to his Rebbe, so devoted to his teacher. He said, if that's what my teacher said to use, even though Rav Huna didn't mean that's what you have to use, he said, that's what you may use. He went out on a limb. He said that these are barely cooked items, beets. I mean, everybody has beets, a little bit of rice. Everybody has rice. He said, that's good enough. That's good enough. It doesn't have to be anything sophisticated. It doesn't have to be a culinary masterpiece. Something cooked. It could be as simple as beets and rice. That's what he's like saying. So Rava said, it can be as simple as beets and rice, which Rav Huna taught as a chiddush, as a novelty. He said, it doesn't need to be some kind of fancy dish. Simple, whatever, just something cooked. As long as it's something cooked, the symbolism we're trying to accomplish is done. We don't know what that symbolism is, by the way, yet, but we'll get to that in a moment. But whatever the symbolism is, simple, simple, whatever, beets and rice. Rava heard his Rebbe say beets and rice, which was kind of on the lowest end of the totem pole. Beets and rice wasn't what it was supposed to be. It could even be beets and rice. Rava heard that from Rav Huna. Now you have the Gemara telling you what the meaning of a chassid is. Have a mahadir asilka v'aroizo. Rava said that I want to use specifically beets and rice. And he said, Rava, you could afford better. He said, yeah, but my Rebbe said beets and rice. And if that's what the Rebbe said, that's what I'm doing. And that's what he did. And he said, Hoyel v'nofik mipumi de Rav Huna. Since this, so to speak, fell from the mouth of Rav Huna. Since this is how, he didn't specifically instruct us. It's a euphemism. It fell from his mouth. He said, oh yeah, even beets and rice would do. He taught even beets and rice? Rava says, that's the way I'm going. And that's what he did. So that's the first statement. First statement is, now what have we discovered from this statement? We've discovered that these cooked items are not item specific. They don't have to be a certain kind of item. It doesn't have to be fine food. It doesn't have to be a culinary masterpiece. It doesn't have to be expensive. What does it have to be? Cooked. That's all. That's all. Something as basic and simple and ordinary as beets and rice. Let me put it this way. Something even a man could cook. Like scrambled eggs. Like, I have a friend of mine who says he's like totally inept in the kitchen. I can make scrambled eggs and lakshan, whatever. This guy's wife asked him to boil eggs and he managed to burn them. I didn't even know how you do it. I told him, you have to put more water in the thing. Chacham, what you are. Like, this is a special talent. This is like a husband on steroids. You burn the boiled eggs. Maybe he could figure out how to make beets and rice. I mean, beets and rice? Anything, just something. That's all. That's why the Mishnah says Shnei Tavshilin. Because the Chazeres is exact. It's specific. Because the matzah is very exact. You got to get a mortgage to finish paying for your matzah. It's very specific. And when we talk about the parperis, we got into the parperis. That's not so exact. That's just called parperis in a broad kind of open language. And now Shnei Tavshilin, two cooked things. What exactly you're cooking? Whatever. You have a responsibility to have two cooked items on your Seder plate. Why? Well, we don't know why yet. But before we're going to analyze why we have to have two cooked items on a Seder plate, the Gemara is going to make an observation. Says the Gemara, Omar Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi taught, Shema Minei, the Rav Huna. We hear, we can understand, it's intimated from the teaching of Rav Huna. It doesn't mean Rav Huna said this, but we can extrapolate from what his words intimate. The Chayish Lei, the Chayish Laha, the Rav Yochanan ben Nuri. We can understand, we can understand from the words of Rav Huna, less the Chayish Lei, Laha, the Rav Yochanan ben Nuri, that he does not consider the concern of Rav Yochanan ben Nuri to be an issue whatsoever. Less the Chayish Lei, no issue. In other words, there was somebody who had an issue, what you would call, if you were to translate this literally, a suspicion, a concern, an anxiety. Maybe this is a problem. No, not a problem. Rav Yochanan ben Nuri raised this problem. It's not a problem. We can understand from Rav Huna that that problem was entirely dismissed. And as far as halacha is concerned, that halacha had no bearing. What are we talking about? What did Rav Yochanan ben Nuri say that somehow got deflected from this teaching of Rav Huna? Says the Gemara, the Tanya, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, the famous sage Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri taught, Oimer, Oirez min dogon. Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri came along and he said, I'm concerned about the rice. I got a rice issue. He said, what's your rice issue? He says, I think rice might be grain. He said, what are you talking about? Rice is not grain. How's rice grain? Grain is grain. There are five grains. He said, yeah, I know. I'm concerned with the grain. I think maybe it's a mindogan. I think it's like a quasi-grain, a kind of grain, a cousin of the grain. I don't know. It somehow is, it's too closely related to grain. It mimics grain. I'm concerned. V'chayovin al-chimutze. And the fermentation or chemical process that would be unleashed when water comes in contact with the rice would be similar to the fermentation that the Torah identifies as chametz, which of course is contraband during the holiday of Passover, during the Yom Tov of Pesach. So what does this mean? How could that even be? Let me just digress for a moment. If you were asked for a description, a definition of chametz, what would you say? What is chametz? Leavened. Most people have no idea what that means, by the way. It's like when I was a boy, we used to put on tefillin with people. So, you know, tefillin. So would you like to put on tefillin? How do you say it in English? So in English, apparently, there's this Latin word that's used, meaning leather frontlets, phylacteries. Phylacteries. So we're little boys, are going out there, we try to speak English. So nobody knows a tefillin, all right? Excuse me, sir. Would you like to put on phylacteries? So what are you talking about, kid? You know, phylacteries. Never heard of such a thing in my life. You hear a tefillin? Yeah, I know what tefillin are. Oh, would you like to put on tefillin? Well, why don't you say so? I thought I was going to say it in English. Phylacteries didn't work. Unless you happen to be talking to a professor of maybe Aristotelian philosophy or a Greek language, ancient Greek language, phylacteries is not going to talk to him. It's not going to mean anything to him. Tefillin? You have a good chance that a Jew will know if he doesn't put on tefillin, at least he heard of tefillin. He knows that's the thing I didn't put on yet. You know, tefillin is a more common word. So if you ask her, what's chametz? Chametz, well, yeah, I know what chametz is. Pasta, pretzels, bread, cookies, I know what chametz is. So what's chametz? What is it? It's leaven. What's leaven? What do you mean it's leaven? I don't know what leaven is. You know what leaven is? The normal people use that word, leaven. Maybe people in the kitchen know what leavening means. What does leaven mean? It's not a $2 word. It's like a $20 word. So how do you define chametz? What exactly is it? Leaven is just a word. It's just like chametz. What's chametz? Chumetz. Okay, thank you.
Less than 12?
11 is less than 12. Shkoyach. That's exactly about how accurate it works for most people. Leaven is 11 less than 12. So what is it? So basically, chametz, if you need to have the technical definition, is a chemical reaction that gets triggered in grain. Grain has certain chemicals. When they come in contact with alkaline, and this is specific, it has to be alkaline. If it's acidic, it's a very different reaction. Alkaline plays with the chemicals that are found in the five grains. And if once again, we could talk about the words that mean nothing to anybody. Amy B. Lacy or Amy C. Lacy is the technical terminology. And what happens is when water or alkaline, anything which is alkaline-based, comes in contact with grain, it triggers a chemical process. When the chemical process is triggered, it takes a little bit of time. But eventually, the symptoms of that chemical process are little tiny air pockets. It starts to expand because it develops these little air pockets. And if you leave it to its own devices for a minimum of 18 minutes, it begins to leaven, meaning it begins to turn into chametz. It's a chemical process. This could also be understood as a fermentation of sorts. What is fermentation? It's a chemical process. The wine ferments. What happens to wine? The nature of grapes is that they have this very powerful acidic chemical, which necessarily will ferment. That's what grapes will do. What happens when you press fresh grapes? There's little bubbles. It's not calm. There's action. There's live yeast. What happens if you leave that live yeast to its own device? It will become wine. It actually develops alcoholic content. What happens to grape juice? Or why doesn't grape juice become wine? Because they kill it. They murder all the chemicals in it. They boil it and they kill the chemicals. So it can't, when it's pasteurized, it can't become wine anymore. Why can't it become wine? Because the properties are no longer alive. They're dead. Which is why grape juice really doesn't work for 4 cups of wine on the Pesach night or for Kiddush, unless you have a problem with alcohol. So, just like grapes have this yeast that ferment, the five grains also have the ability to ferment. Only the grapes, if they're left to their own device, they just have to be released from the grape. When they're in the grape, they don't ferment. Grapes will not ferment in and of themselves. They will cure. You'll get raisins, but raisins will not have alcoholic content. Although the raisins preserve some of the yeast, which is why it's possible to make wine out of raisins. That's what they used to do in the communist countries when religion was outlawed. How did the people make wine? They would buy a lot of raisins clandestinely in different shops with different members of the family, and they would constantly take these raisins and accumulate enough raisins to soak for enough time, and God knows how they did it, but they actually were able to create raisin wine. That's how they used to make wine. Because when you cure it, the curing of raisins is a natural process. When you cure the raisin, some of the yeast is actually maintained and it can be resurrected. It can be resuscitated. But grape juice can never be resuscitated. Once you're dead, you're dead. You can go into hibernation and then wake up. That's what a raisin is. But once you kill them, you kill them. That's it. Then trias amesim has to come. You can't wake the dead up. You can't wake up the grapes. It won't work. Now what happens with the five grains when they come in contact with water, with alkaline? Doesn't water, anything alkaline-based. What happens? It triggers fermentation. How do you stop the fermentation? You kill it. How do you kill it? Very similar to the way they kill the fermentation process in the grapes. How do they kill the yeast in the grapes? They boil them. Extreme heat. So what do they do to the chemicals? They kill them in the fire. They burn them. What happens when they get burnt? They're dead. They can't rise anymore. You leave dough, it can rise and rise and rise. You bake it, it's finished rising. It can't rise anymore. Why? Because it's dead. Dead. Can't rise anymore. Once it's dead, it's dead. So here with matzah, we bake it very quickly before it has a chance to rise. Whereas the rest of the chametz, like bread, pasta, and cookies and cake, it's allowed first to ferment or to become chametz, and then we bake it at a certain point, which gives us nice fluffy or a dense texture, which you can never achieve with matzah. Matzah doesn't have the texture. In fact, we're so nervous about matzah being done right, we make it paper thin like wafers, and we just singe them on the spot because we're worried if you have a thicker dough, maybe some of it won't bake in the middle. You follow what I'm saying? Okay, so how does rice enter into all this? So there is some kind of fermentation process in rice. The question is that fermentation process actual chimutz or not? The fact is that the rice enters the water very, very small. And then the rice gets cooked and it somehow expands very quickly. And then at a certain point, it can't expand anymore. And there's a process, some kind of fermentation, which the Gemara later is going to identify as something called sirchein. It's more like, it's not really fermentation. Fermentation is a sophisticated thing that changes taste. It doesn't really happen with regard to rice. But this is the question of the Gemara. If rice, if the process, the chemical process of rice and alkaline-based liquid is similar to the chemical process of the alkaline-based liquid coming in contact with the five grains. You understand? So the B'yechon HaMenuri says, this worries me. I got an issue with the rice. I don't know, he says. It's too grainy. There's something going on here. It's too close to what we would call the concept of chametz. So that's why Rabbi Yechon ben Nuri said he didn't think it was a good idea for us to use rice on Pesach at all. Now, I have to tell you that this translation I'm going with as rice is not exact or precise. It's broad. It's possible. It's not necessary because we actually aren't certain which is the Gemara's rice. We translate it as rice, but it may not be the rice that we call rice. It may be millet. It may be kasha. What do they call kasha? What is it? Buckwheat. Maybe buckwheat. We're not sure what this rice is. It doesn't necessarily mean our rice. And because of this, incidentally, even what bracha you make on rice is a question. We're not even sure what bracha to make. Some people will say you have to wash and have hamotzi if you want to eat rice, because then if you don't have any question with the bracha. Other people say, if you made a mezonos and you ended up making ha'adama and you ended up making a shakar, well, you did all the blessings, and then you can't go wrong. But so we don't know what to make of, because we're not even sure what the Gemara means when it talks about oruza or or is rice. But the Gemara talks about, we're translating it freely as rice. Chayish le Rabbi Yechon ben Nuri. As we learned, the Tanya Rabbi Yechon ben Nuri Eimer, it is min dogan, it's some kind of grain. The chayavin al chimutz kares. Wow, he says, if you eat this on Pesach, man, you get struck dead. Not lightning bolt, but you eat chametz on Pesach. That's the consequence that comes along. You will die prematurely. And furthermore, Adam yetzi ba yedechi vasa bePesach. There's this marvelous connection between chametz and matzah. You know what can be matzah? Only something that could be chametz. Only something that could be chametz could be matzah. If it couldn't be chametz, it can't be matzah. It has to be the same exact ingredients. The only difference is haste. As Abarbanel and the Rambam and Mor Nevuchim talk about the whole idea of Pesach as haste. Rambam says that the roasting of the Korban Pesach and the haste of the matzah, all of this brings to mind the hastiest way to cook is on the barbecue. You know, you come home, throw stuff in the barbecue, roast it, it's fast. And the idea of the matzah being baked with great haste, it's all things that speak to and of haste. It speaks of haste, reminds us that we chupazon yotzim mitzayim. We left Egypt in great haste. So it's all about haste. And therefore, Rabbi Yechon ben Nuri said, I don't know, I think maybe this is real chametz. And because it's real chametz, maybe you could even use it for Pesach, for matzah. So clearly, Rav Huna didn't seem to be concerned with this. Because Rav Huna said, you can put it on your Seder plate. If you say you can put it on your Seder plate, obviously, it would not be able to be chametz. He said, cook it, put it in a Seder plate. Now, I want to point out to you, Rabbi Yechon ben Nuri's opinion is very powerful, because if he just said, I'm not sure if it's chametz or not, I said, okay, it's a stringency, he wants to go stringent. Just say, I'm not sure if it's chametz. He says, I think you can make matzah out of this. Rabbi Yechon ben Nuri seemed to believe that this is kind of a sub-grain. It's kind of the five grains. And we reject this opinion. And of course, Ashkenazim don't eat rice altogether, and Sephardim do eat rice. And maybe this isn't even the rice that we're talking about. And why don't we eat these legumes? We have different opinions. Somebody is showing him, say, because there's processes that are similar, and if we were to eat rice, eventually we might end up eating chametz itself. Not that we follow the opinion of Rabbi Yechon ben Nuri. Rabbi Yechon ben Nuri's opinion is deflected. It's not an opinion, it's not chametz, it's nothing to talk about. That's where we have the opinion of Rabbi Yechiel Ben Urso. Somebody will come along and say, "Huh, you know what? I think rice should be chametz because I'll show you on the microscope it's Amy B. Maybe this is Amy Z. Or it looks something like it." You say, "You know what? Many years before you had these ideas was a great sage. His name was Rabbi Yechiel Ben Uri. He spoke of it. His ideas were weighed, considered, and rejected. It's not chametz. It's not chametz. So why don't we eat it?" A variety of reasons of why the Ashkenazim took upon themselves not to eat these certain staples, because they could in some way lead us to a weakening of our observance of Pesach. And it should be noted that we must be very scrupulous about this. We take these things very seriously. This is Minhag Yisrael, Minhag Yisrael's Teirahu. And if you're of Ashkenazi descent, don't play games. Don't eat the chametz. And don't even eat kidneys. You're not from Ashkenazi descent, your family always ate kidneys. Enjoy. Nothing wrong. What happens when you have a kosher mixed marriage? What's a kosher mixed marriage? A kosher mixed marriage. Ashkenazi and Sephardi. So what do you do? You follow the customs of the husband. Why? Because being Jewish comes from the mother. And what kind of Jew, whether you're from the tribe of Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, that comes from the father. So therefore it was deemed appropriate. That custom stuff, once the Jewish people divided into different customs, that we adhere to each custom, as the Rambam talks about it in his preface to the book of Mishneh Torah, he says, "Naro, naro, pashta," that once the Sanhedrin lost its central authority, you have to follow the authority of the Torah sages in your area, in your province, in your country, or your part of the world. Once those halachas were established, you can't play around, and then that's halacha, that's what you follow. But it's not because it's a question of chametz. This is out of the question. So that's what we know so far. So far we know, what is the two cooked things? Getting back to the subject at hand, what are the two cooked things? Beets and rice. But not because it has to be beets and rice. Then it would say beets and rice. Anything, even beets and rice. Even beets and rice. They used to say in Poland, many people wanted to have fish for Shabbos, couldn't afford it. What could they get if they were lucky? A little herring. The herring is a fish. So they said, "B'makim she'ein ish," which is a biblical expression. When there's no man, it says, "Be a man." No leader, be a leader. It says, "B'makim she'ein ish," is herring oicha fish. When you got nothing else, a herring becomes a fish. That's called eating fish at Shabbos. Eating a little schmaltz herring. Fish on Shabbos, a nice piece of salmon, a piece of tilapia. This is fish on Shabbos. What, are you joking with me? A piece of herring? So listen, poor, couldn't afford it. All right, herring is oicha fish, fine. With no other choice. Now everybody wants the schmaltz herring, but that's how it goes, always backwards. Herring is also fish. So he says, you need cooked items. A little piece of beet and some rice. Shine. Shine. It's good enough. No, that's what the opinion of Rav Huna is. And Rava was such a great chassid, he assiduously followed his teacher regardless. Okay. Chizkiya Amar. Chizkiya comes along and he says, I'm going to go on a limb out here. He said, I'm going to tell you even more. How could you be more lenient than Rav Huna? Rav Huna said, it doesn't matter, anything. Just two cooked items. Shine, it's good. So Rav Chizkiya comes along and says, Afilu dog ubeitza sha'olav. Even the fish and the egg upon it. What is he referring to? So this is like a fried fish of antiquity. But in these days, we have fish and chips. They make the fish, they make a batter. And the batter is either made of crushed cornflakes or breadcrumbs or whatever else, right? They make a batter with a fish. But apparently, in antiquity, they would fry the fish with an egg batter, like people do on Pesach. Maybe they put some potato or potato starch in or something like that. But something, just a fake schnitzel, fake fried fish. So he says, you could even have a piece of that kind of fried fish sitting on your Seder plate. So that's not two items, that's one item. He says, no. There's the egg around the outside and the fish on the inside. That's good enough, he says. So Rav was following his opinion, the opinion of his teacher. Rav Huna said, two baked items, two things, whatever. It could be the smallest, the cheapest, the easiest to come by. That's good enough. Chizkiya came along and said, I'll go even further. It's so non-issue what the two items are. It could be one dish that's comprised of two different major ingredients, like fish and the covering that's encrusted in some kind of egg fried. That's good enough. It's those two items already. Which is really, that's a real leap. Rashi says, Shahoyu regilum lahatiyach es hadog bebeitzim. They used to kind of wrap the fish in a little bit of egg. Maybe this is the description of the original blintzer, but it was fish inside. So that's good. Put a blintz, a blintzer, a piece of a fried egg with wrapped in. Sure, it's good enough. A salmon blintzer. There is another opinion, the opinion of the Me'idi and other Rishonim. They suggest that it's talking about a fish and the eggs inside it. You know, like the kosher caviar. Caviar is basically fish eggs, right? That's what it is. So there's certain, I think the official caviar is not kosher. It's not from a kosher fish, it's from sturgeon. That's the expensive caviar. But there are certain forms of caviar which are fish eggs, but from kosher fish. So imagine that you have a fish, you catch a fish, and the fish is pregnant. The fish has many fish eggs inside it. And that's where they harvest these fish eggs from. So you have a piece of fish cooked with the fish with the little eggs inside it. So you have basically a fish and caviar. But it's the same fish. That's fine, he says. That's already two items. Two opinions of how we understand this Gemara. That's not Rashi's opinion. Rashi seems clearly to speak about something that's fried in batter. So that's Chizki's opinion. Now the Gemara introduces us, Rav Yosef Amar, a new opinion. Rav Yosef says, Shnei Mini Basar, two kinds of meat. Two kinds of meat. That's really what these two tafshilin should look like. So we talked about what you can get away with, the least possible, the cheapest. And then we have this idea of going a step further. What's a step further? Two pieces of meat. Two pieces of meat, he says. Why do we need two pieces of meat? Says the Gemara, Echad Zecher LePesach, Echad Zecher LeChagiga. A light bulb moment. So that's what this is about. We are trying to simulate the Seder plate of antiquity. We are trying to replicate what the Seder looked like once upon a time. Why didn't they have to tell Jewish people what to put on the table once upon a time? Because they had a Korban Pesach. Nobody had to tell them to put it on the table. It was understood that a Korban Pesach is a central feature on the table. What's the symbolism of the Korban Pesach? We just said it. Haste. It's roasted. And then there was a Korban Chagiga. You're celebrating. It's Yom Tov. We come to the Beis HaMikdash. How does the Dayenu song conclude? The conclusion of the whole journey of Dayenu, Dayenu, Dayenu. God wouldn't do this and wouldn't do that and wouldn't do this. And then we go fill with, Ubarulana's Beis HaBechira. He built us the Beis HaMikdash. And what do you do in the Beis HaMikdash? You come three times a year and you bring a korban, and that korban is a chagiga. It's a holiday offering. It was on the table. It was on the table. So they didn't have to be told once upon a time that you bring a chag. A chag is a holiday. Chagiga is a permutation of chag. Chag is holiday. Chagiga is the celebration of the holiday. It's the name, the euphemism that the korban, that the offering that was brought in honor of the holiday was called. You don't have to tell it to anybody. But then the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed and we don't have these korbanot. What should the Seder plate look like now? We have a problem. So now we have a Mishnah comes along and says, in absence of a Beit HaMikdash, in absence of the offerings, in absence of the natural things, the items that would be on the table, we now have to have something to take its place. So at least we remember a basic criteria, a basic ingredient in the Seder and Seder night. And this is the idea of the two cooked items. One is a Zecher LeKorban Pesach, one is a Zecher LeKorban Chagiga, the big machlekes of the Shoinim. What do you have to do with the Korban Chagiga? Does it have to be roasted also? Because you say everything like the Korban Pesach has to be look like the Korban Pesach. And then, or do we say that the Korban Pesach has to be roasted? The Korban Chagiga could be roast beef, boiled. It doesn't make a difference. It doesn't have to be roasted in that extreme fashion. The Rambam seems to say that it doesn't have to be roasted. And of course, the question is asked in the Rambam, but you say in the Manashtana, Kula Tzoli, everything is roasted. So there are different creative answers about how we reconcile the Rambam's seeming contradiction. At any rate, I don't want to go into it now because it's a subject that's beyond the purview of tonight's Gemara class. The point we're just trying to make is that it wasn't about the roasted, it was about something cooked. Something that had to be modified, not natural, not organic, not a vegetable, not lettuce, not matzah, not baked, and not organic. And not just chopped up because charosis doesn't get cooked. Charosis is chopped. It's all fresh. The lettuce is fresh, the celery or the parsley, the potato actually is cooked, but that's the onion is not cooked, it's fresh. It's fresh. Okay, so these are fresh vegetables. Charosis, chopped up pears and apples and nuts. Everything's natural there. So everything is in a natural state, nothing is cooked. We still haven't found the need for a kitchen. What's the one thing we needed a kitchen for? Ah, for the korbanot. So he says, here you should bring the cooked items onto your Seder plate. I think Jackie Mason once said about Jewish people and their love for sushi. He said, there was a bunch of Jews who had to figure out how to have a restaurant without a kitchen. So they called it sushi. I think he once said something crazy like that. And the point is that on the Seder plate, there's nothing was cooked yet. So the Gemara comes along and says, the Mishnah says, Shnei Tafshilim, two cooked things. Why? Because you can't eat the meat raw. Beef tartare does not work for a korban. How do you have to eat it? So you roast it, treat it, cooked, boiled. However, what it's got to be. So that's what the Shnei Tafshilim are about. Ravina says, you know, afilu garma ubishula. Even if it's a piece of meat and the gravy of the meat, that itself would be sufficient. So you don't really need two items. Two items. Rashi says, echad zecher l'chagigas habasar, to the offering, the holiday offering. Garma ubishula, says Rashi, chatichas basar umin hamarak. Take a little bowl, put the meat and a little bit of the gravy. People can eat gravy, people can eat meat. That's already two items. So that's what the Gemara says. In the time of the Gemara, this is how it was. You brought something to the table. Eventually, of course, the tradition developed that we do bring something specific. Right? So Rav Huna says, beets and rice. Chizkiya says, egg and fish. Rav Yosef says, two kinds of meat. And Ravina says, meat and the gravy. Shine. Okay, what do? So the Ran says that it is very likely that Ravina and Chizkiya, who talked about a one item to Tafshilin, would readily agree to Rav Yosef that at any rate it would be nice to have two cooked meat items. But maybe you don't have two cooked meat items. So he says they were trying to say, what if? Even in a circumstance where you don't have, all right, something. Make do with whatever you can. But ideally it would be two pieces of meat. It's just that it doesn't have to be two pieces of meat. It would be nice if it would be two pieces of meat. And that's where Ravina comes along and he says, you know what? If you have a tafshil of basar, you have a little bit of shine, the gravy, it's like two things already. Chizkiya says, it could be the same item. It's one piece of fried fish. It's not even two pieces. I don't think gravy and meat. It's fried fish. All right, so it's good enough. It's still two things. The Me'iri writes, even though that the primary halacha follows the teaching of Rabbi Yosef, who said, ideally, what should it be? Two pieces of meat. Why? What was the Korban Pesach and the Korban Chagiga? It was a sheep or a goat. It was meat. So this does not make sense. If you're going to have something which is in memory of meat, you should have meat. Even though that's the case. And as the Rambam actually rules, in Hilchos Chametz Matzah, you should bring two pieces of meat. And even though that would seem to be appropriate, nonetheless, the custom for virtually all Jewish people developed. That what do we bring? A zeroya and a beitza. Zeroya and a beitza. And the Me'iri says, and as I said, the Alter Rebbe quotes this in Shulchan Aruch, and the Rebbe speaks about it in Haggadah, that there is also, here we have a very interesting etymological link and connection between the language and between an object. And we know, generally, in our observance, ritual observance of the festivals, that the names of sometimes particular items play a role. It's not only the item, not even the taste or the texture or what it looks like. Sometimes it's the name. I speak specifically with reference to Rosh Hashanah. We were eating carrots, for example. Tzimis. So what's a carrot? What does carrots have to do with Rosh Hashanah? Would you grow like a carrot in the ground? What's the symbolism? So no, because carrots in Yiddish is medin. And medin was, you know, Jews spoke Yiddish for well over 1,000 years. Medin means to increase. And we have this idea, sheyirbu zechuyaseinu, we should increase. I said, we have medin. And what did they eat back in the day when they weren't speaking Yiddish? What they spoke in Aramaic? Silke or Karsi? Other things. We emphasize etymology. Etymology is not irrelevant here. The names that are used are meaningful. And therefore, the Me'iri says, we use something that has a name. And he says, so why do we use Zeroya? Because it says, Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, biyad chazaka, with a mighty hand, uve Zeroya netuya, an outstretched arm. So since Zeroya netuya means an outstretched arm, we take a piece of meat, a bone actually, which is called a zeroya. Right, what's the egg doing there? Ah, the egg. Well, the egg in Aramaic loses the tzadi. We don't say beitza, we say beya. So how does that help anybody? Because we have this idea that in Aramaic we say, bo rachmono, God wanted, or wanted us. Ufurkinon vidro miramimo, and he redeemed us with an upraised hand. So since it says, bo rachmono, God wanted us, it's like, ratzabanu, he wanted us. Since it says, bo, bedro, bo, rachmono, ufarkinon, bedro, miramimo, since it says, bo, and bo sounds like beitza, so then the shank bone and the egg, etymologically, from a verbiage perspective, represent themes of Pesach. So that's what they're doing on the Seder plate. Nothing to do with mourning whatsoever. I challenge anybody to prove that that's more than an urban legend. Show me black and white. Show me anywhere where it says that we're actually doing something for mourning. It doesn't even make any sense. I don't even know how this urban legend began. You're not allowed to exhibit mourning on Yom Tov. It's forbidden. How can it be that we all mourn because an egg is in a shiva? It makes no sense. Anyway, I could be saying something wrong, by the way. Maybe somebody out there is going to come back and say, oh, Rabbi, you're wrong. I found a source. But I didn't find such a source. And the Alter Rebbe definitely doesn't quote such a source, and the Rebbe doesn't quote such a source. All the sources that they quote go back to this Me'iri, and therefore, that's what it is. That's what we do. The Bach in Eirei Chaim wants to explain this idea of the egg. What is the egg doing there? So he says that the Zroya and the Beitza are... They don't get like worse through cooking. You can overcook things. Certain things you can't overcook. You can't overcook an egg, really. My friend burned an egg, but you can't, because there's no water left. You can't overcook it. And in fact, it doesn't. The more you cook it, what happens to the egg? It doesn't melt. The more you cook it, the harder, the tougher it gets. So this is like an element which may be some way distantly related to what people might experience in mourning, but it's not about mourning. It shows the mettle of the Jewish people, the courage of the Jewish people, the strength of the Jewish people, how we overcame exile and slavery and bondage and beatings and murder and all kinds of horrible things, and we're able to rise from the ashes and do incredible things and become Hashem's special people. So this is maybe like some kind of connection to the texture of the egg. But the Me'iri, who is a Rishon, precedes the Bach by many centuries. He clearly states that this is about the idea of the etymology. And so, we will, Bezrat Hashem, have an Aseret plate, a shank. Well, hopefully we'll have Korban Pesach and Chagiga, but if Chas V'Shalom, Mashiach isn't here, by the time this Pesach rolls around, we'll have a Beitza and a Chagiga, a Beitza and a Zroya, but it really, at its root source, is just but a memory, or in lieu of, a talking piece to remind us of the offerings, the Korbanot, which were brought in the Holy Beis HaMikdash. May it be rebuilt speedily, and in our days, amen.